Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for New Books in Japanese Studies, a member of the New Books Network. Today I'll be talking with Dr. Ron Zweigenberg about his book, Nuclear Minds: Cold War Psychological Science and the Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nuclear Minds, which is out from the University of Chicago Press in 2023, explores early efforts by the American military, by psychiatrists, psychologists, and social scientists to understand the effects of the atomic bombings on the minds of those who had survived. In positioning the book as a prehistory of PTSD, Zweigenberg draws attention to the historicity of the idea of psychological trauma before the concept was institutionalized in the DSM in 1980. Nuclear Minds shows that the ideological temperament of Cold War science and the gendered nature of scientific knowledge production versus psychological care were among the factors that led scientists and researchers to minimize, deny, or simply not register as meaningful the suffering of survivors. But also that without our contemporary concept of trauma, or even the category of survivor, the experience of the affected did not always clearly conform to our contemporary expectations. Okay, Dr. Zweigenberg, welcome to the podcast. I know that this is a little bit of a surreal experience being on the other side of the mic for a change. I think many of our listeners know by now that we are more than Dr. Zweigenberg, Dr. Hobson acquaintances. So I'll be calling you Ron throughout. But I have a little bit of an idea about how this book came about, because I was privileged to be part of some of the early talks about it. But I'd love it if you could tell your audience about how this book project came about and how it fits into what you've been doing sort of longer term in your career.
Hi, Nathan. Thank you for having me. And again, and yes, this is it's a bit odd to be on the other side, but fun as well. So as you know, because you were there when we did a postdoc after I finished my first book, Hiroshima book, and we were in I was in postdoc at Yale when you were there as well. There was one chapter I wrote on the Hiroshima book, the first one, Hiroshima. It's about the memory of Hiroshima, but memory culture, memories. It's a memory studies book. And there was one chapter there on PTSD, on post-traumatic stress syndrome, and the origin of it in the research of Robert J. Lifton. Robert J. Lifton was a Jewish-American psychiatrist who visited Hiroshima in 1962. He met with Hiroshima psychologists and did research on Hiroshima survivors that led eventually, that's what I argue in the book, both books, right? One of the main avenues through which we have the category of PTSD. Lifton sat on the committee that that led to the insertion of PTSD into the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistic Manual, the manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which is the official start of PTSD in 1980. I wrote a chapter on it, but I wasn't quite happy with the chapter, as we all are when we write books. We're never quite done with anything we do. And I wanted to get more into what Japanese psychologists did. There was one meeting that I also started this book with, on which I found ample documentation from Lifton in his papers. He wrote a long letter to his to a friend about this, where he talked about meeting a Japanese professor, Hiroshima University professor Kubo Ishitoshi. And this meeting really fascinated me. I really wanted to be a fly on the wall, because the meeting, Lifton himself said in a letter and then also in his memoir, this was kind of the start of his project. This is why he stayed in Hiroshima. This is why he did this. I didn't know much about Kubo, and I was very unhappy with this idea of, you know, Lifton as someone who's coming from outside, an American coming to Hiroshima, and basically, and again, that's not what nobody did. He wouldn't say he did it. Showing the natives, big scare quotes, right? How to do it right. This is, I know I had a friend called the Karate Kid Syndrome, right? Like Tom Cruise teaching the samurai how to be a good samurai, right? Like the white savior coming in. And it's very, very, I wasn't happy with this story, right? And this is not what happened. I'm not saying what happened, but it might look like this. So I went to look into what Kubishitoshi did and what the Japanese psychiatrist and psychologist did. And I thought I'll write an article, which I submitted to one of the most prestigious journals in the field, but it didn't work out, right? It took a long time and a lot of revisions and a lot of back and forth, and then it didn't work out. And then I was like, that's it. I tried, didn't work, got rejected. But so I put it aside, went and wrote another book with Oleg Benesh about castles, something totally different. And just went back to this a couple of years afterwards and started digging more into Kubo Ishitoshi, wrote a couple of articles. Then I realized that there's something there, something more. There is much more before the Kubo Ishitoshi meeting in 1962 that needs to be looked at, because there is something about this that didn't quite work for me. It wasn't what I was hoping or expecting to see. And, you know, this curiosity, this interest in how did people talk about mental damage, right? Before we had the categories that we have now, this is what really kind of the big drive that led me to write this book, really trying to look at, and I know I'm kind of jumping the gun because it's your first question, like what's the prehistory of PTSD, right?
Yeah, no, so this is, thank you for setting up the question, right? Because the way you sort of laid this out in the book is, on the one hand, it is a prehistory of PTSD, right? And you started to talk a little bit about how Lifton is, you know, proximally very involved with creating that as a psychiatric defined syndrome. But at the same time, you know, the book actually isn't about that part of the story so much as about what leads up to his meeting with Kubo in 1962. So yeah, I mean, if you want to talk a little bit more about the prehistory of PTSD part, that's fine. If not, we can go into some of the arguments that you're laying out in your introduction about what leads up to that 1962 meeting and sort of what's happening between 1945 and 1962, when there isn't really a well-defined way of thinking about trauma as the framework for thinking about the victim versus survivor versus trauma, all these different ideas that we have now about how to define what happened in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, not least, but in other places as well.
Yeah, I think for the argument, and I think we can maybe talk about both at the same time, because the idea of a prehistory PTSD is very important for this book, because so much of our understanding of what happened in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Holocaust, and the events of mass death, mass strategy, all around us is so colored by our idea of trauma, right? What there's a book, The Diary of Sin, and someone did called The Empire of Trauma. These are two French authors. I forgot the second one name. And talks about how trauma basically took over all of our categories that really completely dominate our understanding of what happened, how people react to mass violence, how people react to tragedy, how people should behave, this medicalization of the top, medicalization of this is really overwhelming, to an extent that if I tell people that something like that, and this one of my main arguments, people weren't traumatized per se, right? Which I can't stress enough, it doesn't mean they didn't suffer, right? It just means, and that's what I argue in the books, the main argument of the book actually is that trauma was a marginal category. People did not only that the researchers didn't think about this as trauma, and I'm going to talk about it now in a couple of minutes, but people probably, and I say probably because we have no way of knowing, we have ways of knowing, but it's difficult. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit later. Didn't experience it as trauma. What you have with trauma is what the philosopher of science Ian Hawking said, called a looping effect, which means once you have new categories, you have new ways of experiencing, right? So before categories exist, people didn't experience it the same way, right? So if we say that people were traumatized by what happened in 1945, we basically project our own understanding. Svenja Gotterman, who's a historian of medicine, German historian of medicine, who wrote very important book on the reactions of Wehrmacht, of German soldiers, World War II. And she went to look in the case files and she couldn't find trauma. And she said, using trauma is basically putting the very diverse and very different reaction of people at that time into a straitjacket, maybe she quotes something, but into a straitjacket of it's kind of diagnostical history. And this was also my experience. I went back into the files, I went back into the research, into what happened before 1945, right? And I couldn't find trauma. So the book started actually trying to look at what happened, you know, the whole time. That the more and more I kind of dived into those 17 years, and a little bit before, a little bit after, but mostly those 17 years, and try to look at what people did, how did they react to it before this history began, the history that I talk about in my first book, about how Hiroshima, and also in this a little bit, how Hiroshima with the Holocaust and Vietnam, how the people working all this actually came together and produced what we now know as PTSD, what happened before. So this is the main argument, and this is also the crux of the book. How do people react? And what I found was very, very different reactions to the disaster, well, the disaster, to the nuclear attack in 1945.
Yeah, I think this is worth emphasizing that you're sort of intervening against a kind of perhaps unwitting, but a sort of presentism, right? A sense that people, that failure to understand that people in the past were different, right? That the past is a different country, if you want to, is a foreign country or whatever. But it's it's interesting because it seemed to me that this is part of that looping effect that you described is part of a more general sense about Genesis amnesia, right? That you sort of pass a point of no return at which it's impossible to fully recover the sort of the sense memory, the interior emic experience of what it was like before we had a new way to talk about things, a new way to experience things. And so in that sense, I think that it's a book that speaks, with a single case study about PTSD and trauma to a much larger set of historical phenomena and things that we struggle with as historians as well, about that.
I mean, you can say the same thing about feminist history, about history of my point of view of minorities and race before we had our racial theories. I'm not saying at all, and I can't, again, I'm the same way that I'm not saying people didn't suffer. Of course people suffered. Of course people, if you talk about race and discrimination on gender, of course people felt, of course, discrimination and those things that we use our categories now to look at the past. It doesn't mean phenomena did not exist, but they were different. People experienced them different. People had different expectations. And different expectations. And as historians, we have to be very, very careful and sensitive to this. Like one example that I also bring in the book, but also from my personal experience, I bring that's more about being a survivor, but also about trauma. I bring a quote from a Holocaust survivor, a second generation, like someone whose parents were Holocaust survivors. Again, I forgot the name. It's an introduction, I think. And she said, my parents weren't traumatized. They weren't survivors per se. Everybody around them, they had a tough time and it was over and that's it. Everybody suffered. They didn't think about themselves as survivors. They didn't think about themselves as special. Everybody around them. And I saw the same thing in my own family. My grandparents, Holocaust survivors, I grew up with them and no one ever, we didn't have this also when we were younger. I don't think we had the language, right? I don't think we didn't go to our school counselor and talked about trauma or ATG or any of those things, right? So it's coming from this place of trying to talk about people in the terms that they're used at the time in their own terms in a way. So, and again, it's something I still struggle on. I do write about trauma here. I do call it nuclear trauma, but and this is something also Paul Lerner, a lot of people write about trauma, said that trauma, you have to be very, very careful with your application of this. So if they didn't use trauma, what did they use, right? So maybe this is, if we can go beyond, like, why, what did they use? And what I did find is that there's a whole range of categories that they were used, but kind of reused. But what really kind of bring those, all of those categories and ways of looking at it together is the issue that psychologist researchers, by and large, were not concerned with the victims, right? So I make a couple of arguments in the book, right? The trauma is one of them, right? So we can move beyond. And like the second one is that if you look, and this is why I'm doing it as 17 years, if you look at beyond trauma, what you find is that the Kubo-Lifton meeting was not by far the first time that people from the US and Japanese researchers met in Hiroshima, right? The first meeting of psychological researchers, and I say it, and not just psychologists, because psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, people use psychological categories, right? Was almost immediately after the bomb, the first time that they came to Hiroshima. And I found there's this surreal scene in November, December 1945, a couple of weeks after the bomb, where you have researchers with the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, USSBS, running around Hiroshima in jeeps with clipboards, asking people how they felt about the bomb.
It's utterly surreal to you have photographs and passages in the book. It's completely bizarre.
It still blows my mind, really. I mean, one of those people we're going to talk about later, Scotty Matsumoto, was there. Like, I really got, I mean, I talked to his family. I got his papers. I read his reports and letters. And I just, again, the past is out of country. Like, it's a cliche, but you really, really don't understand how it made sense. You know, you drop a weapon of mass destruction on the city and then you walk around and ask people how they felt about it. So this is kind of like the second kind of point here, right? Of like, it really got me into this. Like, how was it possible? So to go back to the argument, right? It's possible because you can think about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in isolation from the longer history of bombing civilians, okay? And the reason I'm saying it is because if you look at the psychological research on the bombing, you'll see the psychological research was not about dealing with the victim and healing the victim of bombing, but from the American, British, German, the bombing side, right? Trying to help the bombers do a better job with destroying the psychological defenses of the victims. And this was my blind spot before, because I went out and looked for psychological research on hibakusha, on survivors, right? Hibakusha is the way in Japanese, survivors of the bomb, right? Couldn't find anything. I mean, I found a couple of things, and we can talk about it later, but not as much as I was expecting, right? But if you try to look at what people did on the other side, right, and you see there's a longer trajectory of psychologists and researchers working with air forces, and this is not just the U.S., but most of the U.S., because the U.S. was in the sanctification of this as an Anglo-American sanctification of bombing and bombing research, not just psychology, also with like the invention of napalm and using math and computers, computerized models, to calculate bomb tonnage and stuff like this. I mean, you know, David Feldman and Kari Karakas do a really good work on this in their new book. It's really an Anglo-American thing. And there I found the researchers. There I found this research. And this is why it makes sense for them to ask those questions on Hiroshima, because what they're after is trying to see if we did a good job. If did we really break the morale of those people? Did the bombing work, right? And there you found this, you found almost most of the research before 1962.
Yeah, I mean, I think to be fair to you here, I think there's no reason you could have really expected to have gone looking for a you know, customer satisfaction survey about the atomic bombing. That wouldn't have been the intuitive place to go looking for something the first time around. So it is sort of interesting that that's, you know, in a sense, the customers are not the people who were bombed, but they're the ones who are being surveyed. The customers are, as you point out, the bombers. But there's this sort of there's this sort of survey that's going on, which is really, it's entirely surprising. I just wanted to say one thing, maybe just taking a step back to the earlier conversation we were having, which is, because I think it relates to this point as well, which is that, this is another good example of how the invention of new categories and new ways of thinking about things, creates these blind spots, right? Which is a big part of your argument. And I think that's true both in terms of, we talked about it in terms of both the experience, right? Now people experience trauma because that's a category of experience. If it's not a category of experience, you may experience something, but it's not necessarily trauma. But this also affects us as researchers as well, right? Which is, I think, a big part of the point. And I think this is a really good illustration of kind of how that happened in the creation of the book and in putting that together.
Yeah, and especially, sorry if I can jump in, like, especially with stuff like this, when this is so emotionally, you experience it in such an emotionally almost paralyzing way, right? It really leads you away from any kind of like rational, you expect that, people react in a certain way because it's how you react, right? When you read accounts of death and suffering, and it's the emotion, as you as a researcher, right? It's really throw you out in a way. I think it's the nature of the material kind of explain why a lot of people, feel like this, that there's no way, they do kind of disservice to the victims in a way by not thinking about it as trauma and as suffering in a way we do.
Yeah. So we've been talking very much about sort of the first set of arguments that the book is making. And I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the second set, which you've alluded to. And that's talking about these sort of questions of objectivity and advocacy, care and inequity that are part of the both the experience of bombing and of being bombed and of then researching, both sort of primary research, the kind of things we were talking about with the clipboards and all, and then thinking about it later. So you have you lay out a second set of arguments that really relates to that part of it. Could you go through that part of the book for us just a little bit here before we jump into some of the chapters?
Yeah, of course. So the nature and thank you for reading so carefully and like finding even better than me the categorization of the arguments that I was making there. So the first one is about again trauma and the nuclear storm. Then like you have a couple of others that connected to power relationship. I think this is the best way to think of it, because as the scene in Hiroshima demonstrate, the relationship between Japanese and Americans was not an equal playing field. Yet when the Americans come to Japan, they pretend as if we are on the same field of objective science, where we all just care for the truth and all use those universal categories and so on and so on. And the Japanese have played this game, right? So, and this is, there's many reasons to this. A lot of the reaction to both in the American side is actually progressive, almost, I'm kind of hesitant to say, anti-racist. Again, we're using contemporary terms, but a reaction to the use of racial categories and quasi-racial categories in the psychological research on Japanese during the war. So this is part of Ruth Benedict's work and others. There is a whole school of psychological science that tried to categorize the Japanese mind during the war, which basically justified, was thinly cloaked racism, right? Japanese as little children, erotic, passive aggressive, and so on and so on. There is some, we can go to it later on, but the people who are writing the surveys and doing the research actually are the people who are reacting against this, right? And they say the Japanese are people just like us. So on the face of it, this is liberal, this is progressive, this allows for collaboration. But the nature of objectivity, especially for researchers from this pretense for objectivity and Miriam Kingsbury do this. I mean, she really good job about doing her work on anthropologists, right? It created some blind spots, and the biggest blind spot is here. There are two biggest blind spots. One, it's very hard in the case of the symptoms we look at to make the causal connection between what happened during the war and symptoms that happened afterwards, and especially when you talk about stuff about nuclear issues, because there's the role of radiation, no one knows about it, and it's very hard to do cause and effect. I mean, do people suffer particular mental issues before because of radiation, because of what happened during the bombing, because of privation after the war, because of the collapse or the value system after defeat, and so on? If you objectivity can be a very good way to dismiss this, right? Right. If and this would happen both in Hiroshima and also in the Holocaust case. In the Holocaust case, you have German researchers looking at Jewish survivors and say, look, the guy was had mental issues before the war, he's had mental issues now. There's no reason objectively to say that the war and the camps and Auschwitz had anything to do with this, right? And Dagmar Herzog and many other people did very good work on show how German researchers used the category of objectivity to deny patient suffering. And in here you have it also, you have the same kind of operation, not out of malice, but in many ways, but also just because people, Japanese researchers want to integrate itself into this world of objective universal science and want to look at patient suffering objectively. So the role of objectivity is one thing, right? And this also leads to another issue of blind spot, which is the lack of a transcultural psychology. Something I expected to find was the Japanese would look at and think about trauma as, because the same way you can think about trauma through time, you can also think through cultures, right? Different cultures react differently to disaster. And I expecting Japanese researchers to be much more sensitive to this, but I couldn't find anything about this, right? There is work at the time. Hari Wu did really good work on transcultural psychology in the WHO. People are doing it at the time. It's not it doesn't exist, but the Japanese don't do that. Why? Again, objectivity, power relations. And in Japanese case, also reaction to Japanese psychology and psychiatry during the war, talk about Yamato Damashi, and we Japanese cannot have shell shock because we have superior Yamato spirit and so on, right? The last set of blind spots is gender. There's also like power relationship is gender. And I argued that, and this is a point made much better than me by Yumi Kim. I wish I read her book, which just won the Fairbank Prize, right? Medicine of Family. That psychiatric care was gendered in Japan. And we kind of made the argument at the same time, which is kind of it's kind of neat. I like it that, you know, kind of same ideas are kind of, if you look at what happened in those years, research was done by men, right? But care was done by women, right? That even though, you know, women are not part of the psychiatric psychology world, right? They're still the one who are dealing with the day-to-day, right? Either at a home, and this is what Yumi Kim is saying, right? Medicine in the family talks about a home, or in the community, or in this case, the people I did look at are social workers, right? Which is a complete female world. Not complete, but 90% female world, where while psychologists, psychiatrists, and institutions didn't give any solutions to those people, the people who had to deal with day-to-day life are women social workers, mostly young, 99% Japanese, a lot of them survivors themselves that had to deal with the care. So this is like the last set of argument that to put it about how the, but a lot of what we know about the way people experience is through female care.
Yeah, so I was thinking about the sort of question of scientific, you know, objectivity, because as you know, I'm sort of working on a STS kind of project myself, and I've been thinking a lot about the problem of the kind of messiness of science in the real world. And psychiatry is a great example of that. And of course, I'm working with nutrition science, which very often has the same kind of problem to a different extent and in a different way, but the same kind of problem of you don't have the sort of Karl Popper model of it's either falsifiable or it's not. We can do an A, B experiment. And that's the only, even though that is what counts for science with a capital S, that you're never going to actually get that. And then how, you know, what does it mean to deviate from that model? What is it, you know, and can you be taken seriously if you don't have an A-B lab experiment, if you don't have something that's falsifiable in that way? And I think that, you know, when science is happening on the ground, as it obviously is in your case, that's, you know, a really interesting problem that I think all science has, but especially when it's happening on the ground, as it was for all of the characters who are involved in your book. And I thought it was, again, really interesting that not only do you have that element, but then you also have the separate problem of these gendered domains of what counts as science and then what counts as, well, care obviously can't be science, even if you could scientize care, which is a whole separate sort of set of issues, right? So I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about the chapters of the book, which are roughly divided into two parts. And the first half, roughly, of the book focuses on the developments in the U.S. In and around psychology and psychiatry up to the time of Lifton's visit to Hiroshima and his meeting with Kubo in 1962. And the second part shifts mostly to the developments in Japan. And so I want to ask you about, it's a little bit of a long passage, and I'm going to quote it here, but I want to ask you to sort of unpack this passage in the book, which to me is kind of the crux. So you're commenting on Lifton's assertion that, quote, no one had attempted a comprehensive psychological study of what had occurred in Hiroshima prior to 1962. And in response to that, you write, and I'm just, this is, here's that long passage, Lifton was not simply uninformed. It's easy to see why he saw the 17 years prior to the 1962 meeting as a gap in research. Lifton's focus and political sensitivities were fundamentally different from those of most who had come before him. While his research focused on the victims and the long-term psychological damage they suffered, almost all the research examined in this book has looked beyond the victims and their psychological suffering. Most researchers, even sympathetic ones like Kubo, saw the hibakusha, the victims, so to speak, the survivors, as a resource. So like I said, I mean, to me, this is kind of the crux of the book, and I want to use this as a way to talk about the two halves of the book, starting with part one. So can you tell us sort of how we get to this point, right? What are the American studies of the atom bombs like from 1945 to 1962? And what does that mean, especially in the context of this passage?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very important passage, which I just come back to. Now thinking, you know, Lifton just had a very large, very long, just this week, a very long interview in the New Yorker. After reading us, I start thinking, and also because of the interview, I start thinking about this and the passage and the importance of Lifton. And as someone who is really an intellectual giant and someone who's so important in the history, yet that I wouldn't say condemn, but like it's really hard to, you know, his role is very complex, right? I mean, in why he kind of dismissed everything came before him. And the other hand, right, he really cared for the victims. And I really tried to think during writing and research about his role here. And I think the main problem, as you say, as Pasha says, is that like, who's in the center of your research? And roughly speaking, in the first part of center of the research is not the victims themselves, but in the American part, the Americans, like future American victim, well, not victim, future hypothetical American victims of the bomb, right? And in the second part is the Japanese victims themselves, right? So this is roughly how you can look at the book. In the first part, what you have is the USSBS researchers and people who came out of it, right? So basically, it look at psychiatrist Alexander Layton. There's possibly one person. You know, you also notice all of them are men until I get to the last part when I talk about social workers. But There's Alexander Layton, who's an American psychiatrist. Then I look at Irving Janis, who is an American psychologist. And I look at Brooke Chisholm, a Canadian psychiatrist. I look at all those men that dealt with nuclear research. And what I see that they think about Hiroshima is a way to think about what's going to happen in America now that the Cold War is starting, and how we can utilize the experience in Hiroshima in order to either prevent the next war or prevent our people to suffer what people in Hiroshima suffered, right? Which is not a bad thing, but it kind of leaves Hiroshima behind. What kind of amazed me, and this is also why I couldn't find stuff about Hibakusha, that those people, most of them, after the first round of research in 1945, no one comes back to Hiroshima, really. No one comes back. No one go and do research in Hiroshima, but they all use this initial research and various other things like the work of John Hersey and others, other testimonies that came out of there, to think about how the next war is going to look like. A lot of those people, not a lot, all of them are military men. All of them are connected to the military industrial complex, the military academic complex, right? Irving Janis worked for the RAND Corporation, Layton, who was in Columbia and Harvard later on. He actually comes from internment camps. Internment camps, a whole other story here that we can go into, but this is basically the prehistory of his prehistory. Like Layton and the Japanese-American researchers that were in Hiroshima, we're going to talk about in the second part, came from internment camps. And they think about the Hibakusha experience, again, as a way to prevent what happens. So on one hand, you have peace activists, people who think about it as on a social level, right? And then on the other hand, you have people who think about the individual level, but not think about how to heal the trauma of the survivors, but how to prevent the trauma. And here, a person named Irving Janis was kind of fascinating work, especially if you think, go back to our conversation about trauma before, you think people can be immunized. Again, this is kind of mind-blowing for us, if you think about it. He is devising theories on how to expose people to low level, what we now call trauma, traumatic experiences, in order for them, when the time comes and a bomb is dropped on the US, people will be immune from trauma. And his theories, in part, were responsible for the fact that the US sent tens of thousands of soldiers with teams of psychologists from John Hopkins and American University in DC to monitor their psychological behavior and see if they are immune by this test to trauma, and giving them radiation poisoning and God knows what else, right? And we don't know because they didn't look for it, right? In order to immune from trauma. So this is, again, a completely different mindset, which you don't expect to find. This is the first part. The second part, which we can talk in more detail a bit, I guess, later, is about people who were on the ground, and people who cared for research or put victims in the center of their study. And this is the Japanese researchers, Kubo Hitoshi and Kunuma Masaho from Hiroshima University, and Japanese-American sociologist, who is in a much more complex situation, Scotty Matsumoto, a Japanese-American, who was a medical sociologist who was in Hiroshima in an American institution called the ABCC, the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, whose job is to work with survivors and make sure that they will come and cooperate with American research. So he has a very complex kind of position here, and he's a very complex and fascinating character. But he's in the second part, he's the Hiroshima part, even though he's American, right? But because he's Japanese American, and he's on the ground, this is why he's in a second part there.
Yeah. So I was thinking as you were talking, this was something that I kind of had in the back of my mind when I was reading the book, but it crystallized for me now that there's a kind of effective altruism vibe to the way that the Americans are treating the aftermath, shall we say, of the bombings, right? Which is that the greatest good can be done by thinking about an indeterminate future situation in which, you know, infinite number of peoples could possibly live in the future. We have to be future oriented in that sense. And what has happened in the past and what is happening on the ground now is, again, you know, not the objective way to prioritize where actual good could be done. And I think there's a little bit of like, of that kind of vibe of convincing yourself that the reason that you're not taking a direct look at what's happening right in front of you and what's and the, in that sense, suffering or whatever, you know, whatever category you want to put it in, the experience of the people who have lived through the bombing, the reason you can excuse yourself from looking at that is because you have a future to plan for, and that's the objectively good and right thing to do. And so I thought it was just, we're living in this sort of weird, you know, effective altruism moment. And I was kind of feeling that same general sort of vibe. Although, you know, I'm not suggesting that the American military are effective altruists. Just to be clear.
And I think it's, the problem is even deeper. It's not that they even excuse themselves from not looking, because they're not even aware they're not looking. And this is denial. This is like very, very important part of it. I have a whole paper on denial that I wrote on the sort of concept of denial. It's not denial, but them, like, even though it did happen, denying suffering, it did happen in the ABCC and other places. It's just they aren't able to see the Japanese sufferers.
Oh yeah, so, that's completely what I mean. I think it's an unconscious thing, right? Where it's not a clear and obvious conscious decision to say, oh well, I don't have to look at these people. It's just that they don't even register because your priorities are so far in a different direction, which is obviously objective and noble and good and, you know, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, that's the other thing. All those people, they're the good guys, right? I mean, we're looking at people, I mean, most of them, not those who work for the military, a lot of them, but a lot of them are the good guys, people who really cared, right? People who cared, people who wanted to help. But the result of their action was neglect of the survivors.
Right. So I want to talk about the second half. And in particular, you've brought up some of these very strong and interesting personalities that populate the second half of your book. So you have Scott Matsumoto of the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission. You have Konuma Masaho, who's a psychiatrist. And then you have Kuboyo Shitoshi, who's the one who meets with Lifton, the psychologist. For listeners who are interested in the personalities, read the book. For reasons of length and, you know, to stay a little bit concise here, I want to focus on how those three people represent different approaches to thinking about and dealing with the aftermath and after effects of the atomic bombing, how they overlap, how they diverge, because I think this is really the point that you're trying to get across by having a chapter that relatively focuses on each of them.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk about Konuma Masao Shunga collection that I found in the archives. But that was one of those archive moments when you look at all this porn that a guy had. Well, respectful, but still. So all those people, right? They're all in Hiroshima. Hiroshima is a small city at the time. They all know each other. They all met each other. Matsumoto and Konuma are friends. They meet for drinks and coffee. Kubo work with both of them. And all of them are part of this nexus where you have American researchers and American research facilities on one hand, and you have the Japanese researchers on the other hand. Then you have the survivors of organizations, you have care workers, you have a whole bunch of people who are concerned with the survivors in Hiroshima, right? And they all have competing interests. And this game of interest, and this is really kind of what drives research in all sorts of directions. Matsumoto is perhaps the best example of this. So his job is not to care, again, not because he doesn't care, but because it's not his job. And he's in a very precarious position. His job is not to research the survivors per se, but to make sure that they cooperate with the American research and are coming up to Hijiyama, up to the hill where the committee is, and to get tested. This is because of the nature of American research, which is focused mostly on radiation research. That's another thing why they're looking at psychiatry. They're mostly biologists, geneticists, and the like. But part of his job is to kind of assess their mental health, right? He doesn't do it per se. The people who do the work on the ground and talk to mostly social workers. One thing that he does do is to create a medical social worker plan, which was really at the time one of the first, the biggest sustained trial and helping survivors deal with the social impact and mental impact of the bomb. But again, those people are also in a precarious position, both Matsumoto being a Japanese-American researcher in a mostly white institute in the 50s, right? And the women workers that work with him, they're in this position where it's hard for them to acknowledge survivor suffering in a way that we would expect them to. And whether they did or not, again, it's an open question, again, because we're blinded by as we said before, by our own cultures, what they should do. And I don't want to condemn them or anyone here for failing to see that. Again, this is me being the historian, right? They just saw what their position conditioned to, right? So Matsumoto, really, he's concerned with bringing them in rather than healing them. Kodama Aki, the main social worker I'm looking at, Japanese survivors herself, have this like kind of how do you say it? Like I don't know, I just the word escaped from English. Tough motherhood, like tough love, right? Attitude towards survivors, like you really have to think about your position, lift yourself up, and like you know, you shouldn't really be whiny about the bomb. The bomb was all, no, like stuff like this, you know, get a job. She's being really on the face of it almost cruel to people, right? But she see it, as you say, altruism, right? She see it as a way to help them, but also because her job is to get them out of the house and into the research institute. And this is kind of one set of people, right? And then you have Kunuma, who is not active politically, who's not active socially, unlike Kubo. He cares for the science. And in here, I argue he's much more affected by the German tradition of medicine that is very hostile to psychology. He keeps looking for somatic explanation. He's also coming from the military, and Japanese military was notoriously hostile to psychiatric and psychological explanation of suffering. Nakamura Eddy did a really good job on this. He just, again, he can't see it. He looks for, he doesn't look for suffering the way we look for it, right? He's looking for like brain lesion and head trauma and stuff like this. And then the third person, Kubo Shitoshi, he's concerned with survivors as, and again, he's concerned with survivors per se, but as a way to promote agenda of peace and reconciliation with the US and anti-nuclear later on. So he's concerned about their voices in order people hear their voices, that they tell their stories. Interestingly, not they telling the story, but telling them through the prism of science, of his prism, objective prism, in order to impact public opinion in Japan and America to promote peace. So eventually, I mean, Kunuma is a little bit more complicated. Basically, for all those people, you know, eventually, even though they put the victims in the center, eventually the end result is of what they do is, again, to look beyond their victims, right? To the peace movement, to science, to the American research institution and needs. And eventually, just like with the first people in the first part, they look beyond the victims also.
Yeah, and I think this is just to echo, you know, part of what you said earlier was that they were the victims, the survivors, the hibakusha were resources for each of these people with their different agendas, right? And that was in some ways the thing that they all agreed on, was that the Hibakusha were resources. And so I think it's interesting, this, you know, this leads us nicely, segues us nicely into the final chapter, where we go from this kind of conjuncture around 1960, you know, the first 15, 20-ish years of dealing with, in various ways, the aftermath of the atomic bombings. In your final chapter, you take us from that point, you know, further into the future, in your prehistory of PTSD, explaining how we get from 1962 to this current understanding of trauma and the inclusion of PTSD in both the popular and the medical lexicon. So how does that post-1962 history diverge from the way that scientists, you know, Kubel, Konema, all these people saw their mission vis-a-vis the bombs, vis-a-vis the Hibakusha, and vis-a-vis society or their individual disciplines, etc.?
Okay, so before I get into post-62, I just want to also mention that in the last chapters that I mentioned, there's another component that I have, which kind of built on what I did in my first book, which is to look beyond Japan and America. As one thing that you know, it is kind of something happening in our field with people at least are trained in the US as a matter of language, mostly look at Japan and America, right? And I wasn't happy with this. I have other languages, I have other, I'm trained in other things. I want to go beyond that, right? And I want to see if something, anything that happened in Hiroshima is exceptional. And it's not, right? If you look at the research done on Holocaust survivors, if you look at the research done on war veterans, in Germany, in Israel, in the UK, the victim of the Blitz, right? All the people we talked about so far, they were completely within the international consensus, right? The difference is that you had people who stood up in the Holocaust context and the Vietnam War veteran context. And this is where Lifton come in, because he was part of the generation, right? People stood up for their patient rights. There was a move in the 60s that coming from anti-nuclear movement, physicians for social responsibility. I forgot the name of them, like a physicians organization, doctors organization that work for peace. And they come from a different sensitivity. And they look at the victims and put it in the center. And it starts in a Holocaust context. And Lifton kind of bring it with him to Hiroshima and take it with him. And this is people who stand for patient right and stand and also see connection between different places, right? Connection between victims of war, victim of domestic violence, right? Victims of this is civil war, right? Era, right? Victim of racial violence. The 60s moment where people see the connections. Which eventually lead to PTSD, and Lifton is very important. He's not the only one by any means. There are so many other people involved, but he's important in bringing Hiroshima into the story. So you have this divergence. Well, in post-1962 in the West, right, largely speaking, right, I mostly mean the US and Europe, but there is the entrance of what we eventually will call PTSD, right? If you look at the reaction to Lifton's work on Hiroshima, to work on Holocaust, work on Vietnam veterans, Lifton was very important in work with Vietnam veterans, you have eventually PTSD. In Japan, what you have is a more of a continuation, but on a different register. So in Japan, and I took the Lifton as a catalyst, it's kind of like present in the book, but it's not really. I mean, his presence is there, but his research is not. It's not really dealt with. It's more about how people reacted to. So you have the rise of a social worker movement, and this is again chapter where I look the most at female social workers. Really, people do amazing work with survivors, but in this case, also the first time politicize their work. Right, and connect testimony with care, right? And the way it's connected through sociologists like Ishida Tadashi and others is that they think, and this is again a very different way to think about it, right? But it's kind of built on Lifton. It's a little bit more complex. It's by telling their story. And this is a very Western idea, right? If you talk about it, right, you feel better. it's a very kind of confession, this confessional idea, right, which PTSD can relate to, the PTSD treatment relate to, right? If you become a witness, you can overcome your suffering. And they're urging people to struggle against the bomb and struggle against the mental price of the bomb. They don't really talk about this, but eventually what happened is that they kind of categorize people as survivors versus victim, not because they have any kind of malice, right? But this is the result of what they do. So PTSD, there's a very negative reaction to Lifton because they think PTSD means that people are kind of stuck with this, you know. There's a very unfortunate mistranslation of Lifton's book called Death in Life that kind of, I don't remember the exact phrase, I mean, it's in a book, that kind of leave the impression that Lifton argued that the death is complete, that survivors cannot overcome their suffering. They're always dead inside, they're kind of walking zombies, right? And survivor and care workers and activists are really, really angry about this. I mean, not all of them, but people who, there's some who were very grateful for Lifton. And this kind of leads into this idea that, and Ishida's very important, like that the way for survivors to deal with mental suffering is to bear witness. But the result is a reaction that rejects PTSD and the work that led to PTSD and emphasize instead the political work of struggle and bearing witness, which leads to dividing the survivors into basically survivors and victims, right? People who overcome their suffering and people who are just still kind of lost because they didn't find a cause. And, you know, as far as I can tell, people who, you know, there are people who, you know, I wouldn't say heal, but they made sense of their suffering through witnessing, right? And there was, but I think, I mean, again, I would not my value. It's not, again, it's like role of historians. It's our job to condemn them. I mean, now as we're talking, I can tell that I think I didn't see it as a very positive way to look at this. That just some people are better than others because they managed to do this overcoming. But again, we have to be very careful when you look at this because for them, they were very dedicated. They're still very dedicated to this, this idea and the way to think about this.
Yeah, and I think also this touches on a conversation that you and I have had in the past about thinking about the you know, how we do history in terms of who leaves behind their voices, right? You know, what sources do we have as historians? And I'm clearly in that, you know, very overgeneralized dichotomy that you were just talking about between, you know, the survivor versus victim, the survivor engaged in finding purpose, engaged in political struggle, et cetera, is going to be the person who leaves behind their voice for us to analyze as historians, whereas the so-called victim very often is left out of that. And I think that's also part of, you know, this overall problem of the kind of value judgments that history, if not historians, end up passing on the objects of our research for reasons that are, you know, in some ways, depressingly beyond our control, but at the same time, we ought to have a little bit more control over. Yeah.
Yeah. And we should be aware again of the stakes, but then again, I mean, I opened a book and this is, I struggle with, as you said, we struggle with it all the time, like whose voices we include. I mean, do we put our value judgment into this and say, this should be included and this shouldn't? I mean, there's two problems here. One, the issue of value judgment, right? Like I opened the book with this quote from Israel Military Stone that said something about, I'll read it. I just like it so much. It says something that, you know, you shouldn't judge your subject. You know, they're not stupid, smart, brave, or cowardly. They are human. Their decisions are influenced by many factors, which often they were not conscious of. The historians have no monopoly on the truth, but as long as he says he, but, you know, you can translate he or she, is honest in his work and he or she are aware that not a few pieces are missing in a puzzle, their writing and exposés might be of some value. And I really like, this is from Amir Amazov, I really like the way he put it. We don't have monopoly on truth. We have a very partial view of the resources we have. They're, as you said, biased by who left sources and who didn't, right? And that's the second problem here, the silence part, right? How do you, this, I end the book with another quote that talks about this, right? It's from Kenzaburo Hiroshima Notes. Ibaksha said that we don't want to talk. we want to be silent. How do you give voice to people who don't want to talk? You know, a lot of history in the last 30, 40 years was and still is moved by the idea of to give voice to the voiceless, which is, of course, I have no problem with this whatsoever. This is, I mean, this is what also I try to do here to a large extent. But what do you do people who don't want a voice, or how do you research silence, right?
Yeah, and methodologically, that's a conversation we're going to still be having. Even if we agree on the sort of the agenda, as you say. So I think this is a nice place to wrap up talking about the book and talk a little bit about. I understand you've been cleansing your palate with a different book project recently, and I want to know what else is on your plate. So what have you been up to other than this collaborative book project that I think you've just completed, if I'm not mistaken?
I just finished a book with Mahon Murphy in Kyoto University on punk in Kyoto. I tend to jump around from things that are very depressing to people, things that are less depressing. So I wrote the Castle book after the first Hiroshima book. Now, Ian Mahon wrote a book about punk in Kyoto. It's a short book. It's done for the 33 and the third series. It's edited by Noriko Manabe in about music in Japan. So this is something we just did. It's about punk in Kyoto. It looks at one place, the Seibukodo, it's a legendary place in Kyoto University, which was still is occupied by the student movement and is kind of a venue for all sorts of theater and music. And in our case, punk, we looked at, utilizing our other identities as people are very much involved with the punk scene. Mahon, not more than me. In Kyoto to look at this. So after finishing this, of course, I have to go back to something very depressing. And now what I work in now also with a colleague, Susanna DiGiubian, who is an expert on human remains and the fate of human remains after the Holocaust. I found, again, in my first book, I found a couple of instances where you have urns full of human remains. From Auschwitz in Hiroshima, in Kyoto, in Nagasaki, in Fukushima, and all sorts of places, and which led me to the question, what are you doing here, right? So I started looking at that, and I kind of partnered with Susanna, who looked at the Polish side and worked on it for quite a while, and we realized this is a worldwide phenomenon. So we're looking at now at like the global circulation of those urns, and more generally speaking, at least from my side, the idea of like human remains after disaster. So also look at human remains in the context of colonialism, like Ainu, Okinawa, the human remains in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the collection of bones. So this is basically what we're kind of into right now. Again, depressing again, so.
Yeah, well, hopefully we will get you back for both the less depressing and the more depressing book projects in the future. But for now, thanks for spending the time with us. Again, on the other side of the microphone, if you will. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. A pleasure for me. Really enjoyed it.